Hello, party people, and welcome to another episode of Office Hours. I am sitting in Vail, Colorado, en route on a road trip cross-country from seeing my mom over in Illinois, going back over to Las Vegas. Stopped over in Vail and had a nice little time in the falling snow. And now I get to sit here by a fire. It's not really that, it's 61 degrees Fahrenheit. It's not really that cold, but isn't it nice that there's a little fire going here? And it's just so romantic while you and I sit together and talk about SQL Server. So the number one question, the top voted question from PollGab, and from those of you who want to ask questions, make sure you read the description of the video. Number one question is from Ms. Cosmos, who says, what are the top traits for the perfect DBA? I think the number one thing is being detail-oriented, is understanding that no one else is going to tell you what parts of SQL Server you need to go investigate and fix. You've got to be detail-oriented to know that you need to check things like backups, patching, error logs, things that aren't necessarily glamorous, but will pay off in terms of reliability. So I think that that's the number one. The number two is the ability to communicate clearly to other people, because you're going to be often in many shops the only person who does your job. No one else will do the same job that you do in most companies. You get to bigger companies and you're a team of DBAs. But in most companies out there, you'll be the only database administrator, and you have to communicate clearly to the sysadmins, to managers, to developers, and so forth, to tell them what you're concerned about, what problems they need to consider addressing, and you need to help understand their problems as well, and clear communication is a big part of that. Next up, Boris asks, what is your top SQL audit horror story? See, this is a little tricky because I don't know whether Boris is referring to the audit functionality in SQL Server or the performance tuning type work that I do. I don't do any like auditing for security purposes. If you're asking about the audit feature in SQL Server, my favorite horror story is just the fact that it doesn't work very well. If you set it up to write to a location that needs to be tamper-proof so that it's legally defensible in a court of law, writing to a tamper-proof location, well, database administrators can often modify that location, can write to the file contents in that area. So if you want to set it up that it's impenetrable by database administrators so that only the security team can track the auditing, then at that point, it's got to be written to a file share that the database admins don't have rights to. And when you start writing every audit line across the network, the easy way to hack around that, you just drop in a host file so that that location is temporarily inaccessible to the server. If you want to defend from that, then you're talking about configuring SQL audit so that it shuts down the SQL server if that file target is inaccessible, and that opens up a whole other availability can of worms. So everything about the audit functionality built into SQL Server is a horror story for me. If you're asking about the work that I do where I do the SQL critical care, where I parachute in and I take control of a SQL server and figure out what's going on with it and what we need to do to get across the finish line, my favorite horror story from there, and I can remember it clearly because I happened to be talking to a friend of mine about this, is that I went into an office and there was a whole team of people inside the office and we had the SQL server up on a projector. And as we're talking about what's going on the server, the database administrator connects into the SQL server, remote desktops directly into the SQL server, which I'm not a fan of to begin with. Remote desktops directly into there, and as soon as they log in, there's a little pop-up down by the tray, and he immediately X's it, immediately closes it. And I read it. I read it, just glanced at it really fast, and it said something about the C drive running out of space. And I said to the database administrator, I said, what was that thing that you just closed there? I always like to play kind of stupid. I said, what was that thing you just closed there? And he said, it's no big deal. We've been running out of space for weeks. And I'm like, on the C drive? Really? That doesn't concern you? And sure enough, within the first hour, the C drive completely ran out of space and the SQL server shut down, was unavailable, problems with the database log file growing, and all kinds of hell broke loose. So that was one of my favorite ugly moments for somebody managing a SQL server. I'm like, we're off to a real bad start if you begin by ignoring that the C drive's running out of space. Let's see, next up, Midwest DBA asks, my friend is assisting with designing a new data warehouse for the BI team. They really want high availability and disaster recovery for their data warehouse. I've never managed a data warehouse that had high availability and disaster recovery. It's really common. What issues could occur if we're using failover clustering for high availability and log shipping for disaster recovery or availability groups for HA? Okay, I'm going to set aside the what issues could occur with failover clustering or availability groups or log shipping with any database, because of course that, with any database you can run into all kinds of problems. But I'm going to specifically talk about data warehouses. The problem, number one problem that you're going to run into with data warehouses is they tend to have jobs that take hours to run. A load job, a reload job, a reporting roll-up table, repopulation job. And the thing you need to ask your data warehouse team is, if this server fails over in the middle of one of those jobs, what do you do? Like if the SQL server restarted today and some transactions rolled forward and some rolled backwards, during the middle of your load, what are you going to do? And if they say, oh, it's no big deal, we have restartability built into our packages, then you're probably going to be fine. If they say, well, we restart the load from the beginning and we're really used to doing that, you're probably also going to be fine. What you have to look out for is the team that says, why would the SQL Server restart? Well, it can't do that. We can't have data loss. We can't have downtime. Because the reality is, even when you have failover clusters, availability groups, and log shipping, you will have downtime during a failover. Some transactions will roll forward, some transactions will roll backwards, and it's going to be up to the data warehouse team to figure out what point their load is at when the server comes up on the other side. By far and away, the biggest issue that I've run into. Next up, user called I Use Lowercase for Select says, hi Brent, I just watched Bob Ward's pitch for SQL Server 2022. Does compat level 160 really solve the parameter sniffing problem as suggested by Microsoft? Well, you got to be careful and make sure that to ask questions of Bob Ward's the presenter who did that session. Make sure to ask questions of Bob and ask him that same thing. Does it solve parameter sniffing? And Bob will be the first to tell you, because I've sat in Bob's sessions about this exact feature, and Bob's an extremely honest person. I don't think I've ever heard him try to hoodwink anybody. He's very upfront and clear, and he'll say this does not solve parameter sniffing. All it does is try to mitigate specific kinds of parameter sniffing. It's not going to fix every case of parameter sniffing. It just fixes some cases. And that's absolutely true. It has the potential to fix some cases. Now, the dark side of that, as it's implemented today, is that right now, when you pop into 160 compat level, it basically breaks a lot of monitoring tools. The way that they shipped CTP 2.0 and the way that they implemented parameter-sensitive plan optimization, it's no longer possible to figure out which queries belong to which stored procedures or which applications. Right now, the state of SQL Server 2022, if you had to adopt it today, I would tell you under no circumstances should you even go near it. But hopefully that's a problem. It's just with CTP2, and they'll be able to fix that before they go live. I'm a huge fan of the changes that they've theoretically made, but the way that they're practically implemented as of CTP2, it's a poop show. Next up, Jonas asks, did your parents instill you with the desire to teach? Were they teachers? No. My parents instilled me with a lot of good stuff, and I'm wonderfully thankful to them, and we get along great, and I love them dearly. They instilled in me the desire to learn, not as much the desire to teach. The thing that instilled me the desire to teach was I used to work in the hotel business, the hospitality business, hotels and restaurants. And it's fairly unusual in the United States for someone to want to stay in hospitality for their entire career. People go into hospitality and they want to work the front desk or housekeeping or wait tables or cook the line in a kitchen for short periods of time until they can do something else. So as a result, in the hospitality business, you're continuously teaching people how to do things because you have a revolving door. Everybody from accounting to front desk to housekeeping, you're continuously teaching people. And so I really got used to it there and enjoyed it there. That was where I really got my start teaching. Next up, Statistics Rules asks, hi Brent, what are you most excited about in the coming release of SQL Server 2022? And he says, thanks for your epic contributions to the community. You're welcome. The thing that I'm most excited about personally is the continued paying down of technical debt. So there are a lot of features that when they came out, Microsoft made a big deal out of them as if they were awesome, but they didn't work very well. And my gauge for success is always that if Microsoft continues to make a feature better, that's awesome. If they just lob some flaming bag of poop out onto our doorstep and then walk away from it, that's no bueno. And so there are several gradual incremental improvements that I'm excited about. Query store continues to get improved. Parallelism and MaxDop feedback continues to get improved. Adaptive memory grants continues to get better. What's the other one I was going to say? The cardinality estimator feedback is getting better. These are all iterative changes that won't make the front page, but I'm just glad that Microsoft is continuing to fix things that shipped as kind of broken. Kind of broken is a stretch. I mean, they're not terrible, but they're just not great. People have been hoodwinked into thinking one way about how parallelism works, for example, and it doesn't really work that way. Next up, perfect tie-in there. Jim asks, what is your opinion of the degree of parallelism feedback in SQL Server 2022? Will this get shops over the finish line? So the way that parallelism works today is most people don't understand that MaxDop is really just DOP. Max degrees of parallelism isn't a maximum. It's the degrees of parallelism. So your query that doesn't really need much in terms of CPU is jumping straight up to 8 cores or 12 cores or 16 cores depending on how you configured MaxDop. And as a result, we have all these parallelism weights. We have problems balancing work across worker threads. We're spinning up worker threads where it's not necessary. And so Microsoft, for the first time in 22 years, is actually going back and saying, you know what? Maybe MaxDop should really mean something. Maybe it should really mean maximum. And so the degree of parallelism feedback is going to iterate and change over time. I haven't tested that yet in 2022. To be clear, I've read the documentation on it, but I haven't touched how it works. And my fear is that it behaves exactly the same way that adaptive memory grants behaved in 2019. It's basically always looking in the rearview mirror at the number of threads your query used last time and the parallelism weights last time. And that doesn't really make any sense for the majority of queries out there which use parameters. They don't go single-threaded. So I think it's an interesting first step, but like adaptive memory grants and scalar function inlining were the two features that I actively told customers to turn off in 2019. I'm waiting to see whether or not MaxDop or degree of parallelism feedback makes that same cut. Next up, Vegas DBA asks, how are you enjoying living in Las Vegas? Any off-the-beaten-path places that you would recommend? I've been here for 20-plus years and love it. Because I haven't been there that long, I don't have any off-the-beaten-path places that I would recommend. I'm still hitting the beaten path, so to speak. But I love Las Vegas. I love the restaurants, the shopping, the entertainment that's available all the time there on the Strip if you want it. Or you can drive 15 minutes and be in a nice, quiet, mature neighborhood like I'm in. And the driving roads are fantastic. But and like note the fact that I'm recording this in Vail. I for the first couple of months that I took possession of the house in Vegas, a lot of the time has actually been spent on the road. So I can't give too much detailed recommendations yet. We found a really good soup dumpling place, but I don't remember the name offhand. I'll have to get back to you on that one. Next up, Don't Bother Andy asks, is CU16 ready for prime time? So SQL Server 2019 Cumulative Update 16 has a known issue where they changed, that Microsoft calls it a feature, not a known issue, but I would call it a known issue because it can break log shipping if you're doing transparent data encryption. They changed the backup file format for the first, I've never heard of them doing this, but they changed the backup file format if you use TDE and compression. So any backup that's done with TDE and compression on CU16 cannot be restored to CU15 or earlier. This is an unheard of breaking change in terms of backup and restore. And it just means that if you decide to go to CU16 on one server, you got to go to CU16 on all of your servers. That kind of sketches me out because the reason that I found out about that problem was I had a client whose log shipping broke. I was actually right at a desk over there working on it. Their log shipping broke because they tried to go back from a CU16 server to a CU15 server. That makes me really nervous, so I would probably wait out CU16 just a bit. I heard from other people that it's the CU that removes the log4j vulnerability for SSIS, but I don't do SSIS work, so I can't really comment on that. Merge It Like It's Hot asks, hi Brent, we have some very sensitive tables that we work on, and before we update any value on that table, we back up the entire table for fast recovery. What in the hell are you thinking? Why don't you just back up the rows that change? Why don't you just put in a trigger and log things to another table? You could replicate things. There's so many ways you could do that better. He says, do you recommend using temporal tables instead? Oh, okay. Oh, that's an interesting use for temporal tables. I guess I would. I guess that's not so bad. Temporal tables would give you the ability to restore single rows based on their changes. It sounds like you have an extremely low change rate because it's not like you would back up the entire table all that frequently. I don't have a problem with temporal tables for that use case. That seems like it's pretty smart. I would just make sure that you clean out the history tables because it's not like you need that much history. You probably only need like 30 days worth of history, it sounds like, based on your use case. But it's an intriguing use for that. Next up, SQL for the Win asks, what is the best way to manage index deployments across multiple RDS instances? And really, it doesn't need to be RDS for this case. That could be any instance. We have an application deployed in three regions, and we need to deploy the same indexes across the instances. A popular way to do that is Redgate schema control. Redgate Schema Control will compare databases and give you change scripts to make all of them match. It's automatable with PowerShell. I haven't done it personally. I just have clients who've done it, a lot of clients who've done that. So that's probably the problem or the place that I would start, Redgate Schema Control. You said in terms of what's the best way, I would say that's the one that I hear the most often, so I would roll with that. And I've never heard someone say, oh my God, I got to get rid of this application because it's unworkable. Like the people who use it for that kind of purpose, they seem to be pretty doggone happy with it. Turner Byrne asks, I have a table that contains no primary key, but it has a non-unique clustered index containing three columns and the form of da, da, da. Is there an advantage with this design? I really can't tell. Do data modeling advice based on a word problem? That's like a train leaves Philadelphia at 3 o'clock. Am I wearing the right underpants? For me to do schema analysis and give you advice, I would really need to look at the database schema. I'm not saying that you should type that into PolGab. Of course, that's just an example of a question that just doesn't really make sense for PolGab. The question I would ask is, what's the problem that you need to solve? Anytime that you have an existing table, any kind of change equals risk. I don't want you to have to modify the table in order to get some kind of perceived benefit. Is it a problem for you today? If it's not a problem for you, put it down and go ask your users what their problems are. Loaded question there, right? Jason Burton asks, how do you stay current with such a variety of skill sets? I don't think I actually have a variety of skill sets. Okay, so there's a few ways that you can describe your skill sets. One is really wide but shallow, as in, I know about a whole lot of concepts, but I don't know very much about them. A common term for that is jack of all trades. When you work in a small company or on a small team, you often have very wide skills that don't go very deep because you constantly have to jump around to different tools. Another way to think of it is deep but narrow. A different set of skill sets there is deep, like you know a whole lot about just a few things, but not much about anything else. When you work in a very large company, you can afford to have a very deep skill set that's just, excuse me, goodness, very narrow. And to some extent, that's what I have with SQL Server performance tuning these days. Another way that you can look at it is a T-shaped skill set, where you know a lot about a lot of things, but only very narrow, and then incredibly deep about one thing. That's really what I have these days, is a T-shaped skill set. I know a lot about what happens inside of the SQL Server engine, not SSIS, RS, Azure Managed Instances, anything that's on. I know a lot about the SQL Server engine. And then if you want to do performance tuning, I know a whole hell of a lot about that. But the instant that you step off of that, like I talk a lot about things like AWS Aurora or Postgres or AWS Lambda or Redis, my skills there, like if you even scratch the surface, you're like, whoop, we got to the depth of Brent's skills. That's all there is. So it really doesn't take a lot to get to the depth of my skills there. I have a very T-shaped skill set. Now, in terms of the depth part of performance tuning, well, the only time that changes is when I hit a problem I've never hit before, which is fairly unusual and involves a client paying the bill anyway, or when there's a new version of SQL Server. When there's a new version, the honest answer is I just block out huge chunks of my calendar and I go bang on it and I do all kinds of work on it. You see the same thing out of bloggers like Eric Darling, Paul White, Aaron Bertrand, Itzik Ben-Gon, that we just sit there and the instant a CTP comes out, we beat the daylights out of it, throwing all kinds of queries against it in order to figure out where the weak spots are. Eric Darling, if you follow him on Twitter, has been doing a great job of digging into the CTP 2.0 of SQL Server 2022. I have only barely even scratched the surface of that because I'm out on the road for a couple of weeks. But we just spend a whole lot of time on it. For the wide part that's very shallow, My favorite resource is Hacker News. I learn all kinds of stuff off of Hacker News. If you Google for Hacker News, it's kind of like Reddit, but for architects and developers. And it's there's a whole lot of snark and a whole lot of misinformation on there. But the longer that you read through it, the more interesting tidbits that you go and gain. And then finally, the last question in here that's upvoted is Beaker. Beaker asks, are DBAs typically disliked by their coworkers? Yes, because the job of database administrator often involves telling people, no. No, you can't write it that way. No, you can't have access to production. No, you can't store files in the database. No, I can't give you a backup from production. No, we can't run SQL Server on your laptop. There's a lot of no answers that come in. In my line of work, in the performance tuning line of work, I tend to be really liked by my customers because I can, it sounds like a brag, but it's because they can bring me something and I can go, watch this, abracadabra, poof, and then all of a sudden it goes faster. So development DBA tends to be a role that is widely liked because you make huge improvements on performance with relatively little amounts of work. Production DBAs tend to be the ones that are pretty widely disliked. And he follows up with, should we care? If being liked by your coworkers is important to you, if you're a production DBA, work in a large company because your coworkers will be other DBAs. You'll be working in a team of 5 or 10 or 20 database administrators. And at that point, you kind of have your own network and they'll like you if you're skilled and, you know, a decent people person. If you don't want to work in a large company or you work in small teams and you really want to be liked by your coworkers, the development DBA role is probably better because everybody likes it when you make the application go faster. And that is office hours for today. If you want to ask your own question, read the description on the video. There's a link over there to PollGab. And it is in the evening now. I am going to call it quits and get some sleep before I have like a 10-hour drive back to Vegas tomorrow. So I will see y'all on the next Office Hours. Adios.